Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
This is Le Show. Before Katrina, this program was occasionally punctuated by a series of interviews / performances with New Orleans piano players with whom I am unabashedly in something resembling love, the safe kind of love. And it is now time, we're far enough along that I've decided to pick up the thread, and no better person to do it with than the most amazing practitioner of the keys and of the of the vocal mic that's working in New Orleans today, and a friend, Mr. John Cleary. John, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. You don't talk like a New Orleanian. This suggests you come from somewhere else.
Either that or I practice an English accent every day.
You sit and watch Masterpiece Theatre when you should be woodshedding.
No, I'm from London originally, but I moved here as a teenager 30 years ago.
Whew.
Which is mind-boggling when I say it. It doesn't seem like 30 years, but I came here in 1980. Just in time to catch the kind of the last of all the great R&B guys that were still on good form.
You saw Professor Longhair?
No. Unfortunately, I got here just too late for Fess. That was a real shame. But I got to see James Booker, who played in my local bar every Tuesday night, and Roosevelt Sykes would hang out in the bar and play in the daytime. The Honey Dripper. And the night I arrived, Earl King was playing.
Oh.
So I got to see these guys who, for me, were just names on the back of very hard-to-find records, you know. And I was very lucky. I ended up actually getting to becoming friends with a bunch of them, and they would call me and ask me to come play. So I got to being in awe of them from a great distance all the way over in Europe. And then the next minute I'm in New Orleans, and I'm actually getting hired to do gigs with them.
And this suggests that you didn't experience any of the you're an outsider, you don't belong here, get out of here, that people might think would happen.
No, a lot of people ask me about that. And the best musicians, the guys that were really good at it, didn't care. Well, the people here are very welcoming from the outside. On the condition, as long as you can play. I mean, if you can play, that's the only prerequisite. Mm-hmm. You know, so everything else doesn't really matter.
So you must have been in some kind of hog heaven as this all came down.
Well, I was, and I think I probably got a lot of the gigs by default, really, because it was amazing to me that at the time I arrived there, it seemed to be very few people who were actually playing what I understood to be New Orleans piano. The greatest one of all, James Booker, was working regularly, but he was ignored pretty much.
Mm.
You know, he played at my local bar every Tuesday night.
The Maple Leaf?
At the Maple Leaf, yeah. And the place would often be empty.
Mm. Well, you hear those recordings of him at the Maple Leaf, and then you hear...
Yeah, I was there on those nights when they... they recorded every week, so I was there all the time. I had a job painting the bar, and often I would come in... Actually, that's how I got my first piano gig, because I was a guitar player. I played guitar as a kid. And that was my main instrument. When I arrived in New Orleans, I got a job painting the bar. And on Tuesday, the deal was we worked whatever hours we wanted. This was the job offer. You can work whatever hours you want. You get free drink while you work.
So stretch it out.
Yeah, half price drink any other time. You get to see all the bands for free. It was great, man. I was 17 years old in heaven.
Mm.
But we'd start work very late, very hungover, and be getting through long after dark. We're paint outside on the ladders painting in the dark, two crazy 17-year-olds. And as Booker was getting ready to start playing, I would usually be scrubbing, trying to get all the green paint off myself and cleaning brushes and stuff. And on those occasions where he didn't show up or showed up late, they would ask me to play just to keep those few customers who actually paid money to come and see him. To keep them in the bar.
So they'd buy some drinks. Yeah.
So they get me to play, and I play whatever songs I knew until Booker showed up. That's how I started doing piano gigs.
Wow.
But he was the main guy, really. Dr. John was one of my legends, one of my heroes. You know, he didn't live in New Orleans at that time, so it was unusual to see him.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other guys who were around, but not... I mean, I really came here thinking that there was a town full of piano players. You know, New Orleans has that reputation.
Yeah.
So when I did get to play with guys like Earl King and Cato and Jesse Hill and Snooks and people like that. I think I got asked back because I actually knew a lot of the material because I'd grown up listening to that stuff.
This had been what you'd been listening to in back in England.
Yeah, yeah. I had an uncle who used to live in New Orleans, and he had mountains of 45s. And every night up at his house was an education. They would start with a Clifton Chenier 45, and then in the process of trying to find a particular song, he'd unearth all these other dusty old 45s, and it would be Clarence Henry and Jiving Gene and the Jokers, Professor Longhair, Huey Smith, and... it was great, yeah. So I got a thorough grounding in New Orleans R&B.
And then would you go home and try to play what you just heard? Or
yeah, yeah. I remember trying to play Big Chief. Big Chief, it took me two hands, and I was playing in the wrong key. It would be like... and now it's, you know... riff would, a lot of this stuff would take two hands. This riff, that's the classic New Orleans
turnaround
lick.
Yeah.
I started messing with that stuff when I was about 11 or 12.
And then when you came here, did anybody say, young fella, here's how you do that, or you just picked that up as you went along?
I just picked it up. There's no laws, there's no rules, and really in all the, you know, through the history of New Orleans, the guys that made a difference are the ones that threw the rule books out the window. I mean, that riff I was just playing, that Professor Longhair thing. There was nothing like that before he did it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's from New Orleans. There's no doubt that what he plays is from New Orleans. But that didn't really have any precedent. And I think, you know, when you look at the great moments in New Orleans musical history, whether it's Jelly Roll Morton right up to the Meters, they play the way they play by virtue of being here from New Orleans. But it's not a matter of adhering to an academic... set of rules that this is how you do it.
It's how you feel it.
Yes, yeah, how you feel it. Yeah. And you kind of, I think to play New Orleans music right, you have to come and live in New Orleans. That's the difference. And you soak it up as a process of osmosis. You just breathe, you go to your second line at funerals, you go jump in and step at a Mardi Gras parade, and it just gradually soaks in.
That's a high price to pay, isn't it? To be able to play this music, to have to live
yes,
here.
It's tough
work. Why don't you show us what you've soaked up for a moment here?
Well, I play my favorite thing, one that I play on at all the gigs, and it's a Professor Longhair tune, and I heard the Fess version, and I heard a solo version that Dr. John did of it when I was a kid, first checking this stuff out, and there was one particular riff that just took my breath away, which is... and I'll show you where it comes in. So it's Tipitina. And Tipitina was a tune that was a hit for Fess, and it was one of a long line of tunes that used the same basic chord changes, the fundamental root of which, way back in the day, they used to call the Junkers Blues.
Mm.
And they used the same chord progression with various sets of lyrics and various arrangements, but always fundamentally the same basic 1-4-5 changes. And at one point it was called Tina Na. At one point they used it for Lordy Miss Claudie, for Stagger Lee, the Fat Man, Champion Jack Dupree way back with Junkers Blues, and even way before that. But it was a very basic fundamental blues. I think early on anybody could pretty much play it. I guess in the early version, early incarnation, it would have been... pretty basic stuff. And then when Fess got hold of it, it turned into more of a... although actually this isn't really true to the Professor Longhair. I think this is more like what Dr. John did with it. I like to make it even funky like this.
No syncopation there.
Syncopation is the root of all that stuff. You got to break music down into the rhythm and the harmony. And New Orleans is part of that word that includes Cuba, Haiti, where the way you break up four beats of a bar is turned into advanced mathematics. You know, and then in New Orleans, the way they approach harmony and the chord progressions and melody, that's very important too. So it's a marriage of those two things. So you have to get those ingredients right. Yeah.
No kidding.
And it doesn't have to be sophisticated necessarily. You can have the grittiest, funkiest, lowest common denominator. But a lot of the great musicians in New Orleans can do that. And then at the drop of a hat, if it's necessary, it can suddenly blossom into this gorgeous, extravagant, delicate...
Baroque structure.
Yeah. Masterpiece. Something beautiful, complicated, sophisticated. You know.
Where the hell's the one? Where the hell's the root?
Uh-huh.
Leaving the audience, if they're drunk enough, in the dust of...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then and then you surprise them by saying, here it is. It was here all along.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people first got to know you around the country when you opened for Bonnie Raitt and toured with Bonnie Raitt for a good few years. What is that, 3-4 years?
I was playing with Bonnie for 10 years.
Good Lord.
I know. It flew by really quickly.
Yeah.
Well, before that, I was playing with Taj Mahal. I mean, I'd played in New Orleans for years in little clubs in New Orleans, and you can make a living in New Orleans playing without going anywhere else. And you can, a lot of people are quite happy doing that. A lot of people don't want to tour necessarily, and you can make, have a lifelong career here, and no one ever hears of you outside of Orleans Parish.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a job playing piano for Taj Mahal, who was one of my idols.
Mm-hmm.
He lives out in California. And so that was my first experience, really, of touring outside of New Orleans. And that lasted for a few years, and from that, I got acquainted with Bonnie, and then Bonnie asked me to come and play with her. So it was very interesting. You know, it's such a... Well, fundamentally, the music that is no different. What I do as a piano player is not very different, really. And that was, I think, why she hired me, because she liked that style, obviously. But the... you know, the level of professionalism and the actual business side of it was quite eye-opening for me, from coming from down here. coming from New Orleans, just the fact there was a business side.
The business side of it, yeah. What do you mean?
So that was really good. Good experience, yeah.
She allowed you to open for her, so the audience didn't see you just as a sideman, right? They saw you
She was always very generous in letting me take solos and join her on the vocals, and she would perform songs that I'd written. And then I get to stretch out and play some mandolin and some guitar and some percussion and do some other bits and pieces too. So, yeah, it was great. Yeah.
How long have you been writing songs?
I've been writing songs... for as long as I've been playing, really, I guess, yeah. Sort of making things up and, you know. When you're playing the kind of music I play, you write every time you sit down and play. There are some aspects of music and some musicians who will perform set pieces where essentially note for note is identical from one night to the next. That doesn't really work that way down here. And so you compose and you improvise. So it's all spontaneous. So every time you play, you're composing, really, and writing.
Some would say that's a lot of pressure.
For me, there would be much more pressure to try and do the same thing twice. I wasn't a classically trained musician. I was taught by family members who were musicians. So I learned to play by ear, by trial and error, by listening to records, by sneaking out and seeing bands whenever I... was able to.
And when did you first start singing?
I've always sung, as long as I can remember. When I was a little kid, my parents would have parties and there'd be musicians playing, and I would go and sneak, you know, long past my bedtime, and I would be, I'd get up and go and stand by the door and listen, and they'd find out sooner or later that I was there. And I was allowed to stay up on the condition that I sang. And Jesse James was the song I sang. That was the only song I knew. So I'd sing Jesse James, and they'd let me stay up and listen to the music. So I've been singing since I was about 5, yeah.
Could I ask you to do a song with a vocal part in it?
Sure. Let me think what I'm going to play. Let me see. Right here. Let me play. I'm going to play this song that I used to play with Snooks Eaglin, just because it's the first thing that pops into my head. And this is a Benny King tune from back in the day. Every time I kiss somebody new, make believe I'm kissing you. I can't keep my aching heart. I know we're still apart, baby. Each night seems like a thousand years old. I can't lose these young boy blues. Make me cry when I hear your name. And if I cry, you know I feel so ashamed. And I can't get my aching heart. My heart knows we're still apart, baby, now. Each night is like a thousand years old. I can't lose these young boy blues. Don't know where to go. Don't know what to do now, baby. Well, I'm so lost and worried since you went away. Every time I kiss somebody new, make believe I'm kissing you. And I can't get my aching heart. My heart knows we're still apart, baby. Each night feels like a thousand years old. I can't lose these young boy blues. Each night feels like a thousand years old. I can't lose these young boy blues, no, no.
From the British newspaper The Independent, in the most explosive day of evidence to date in the Iraq inquiry in Britain, they heard that both Lord Goldsmith, who was Attorney General under Tony Blair, and Jack Straw, at the time Foreign Secretary of the UK during the time of the Iraq invasion, brushed aside the unwelcome verdicts of leading international lawyers within the Foreign Office of the UK. Sir Michael Wood, the department's chief legal advisor, revealed at the hearing that he believed the March 2003 invasion was, quote, contrary to international law, don't you know? He said he considered resigning in the days before troops moved into Iraq after his deputy, Elizabeth Wilmshurst, did the same in protest. Declassified documents showed he repeatedly warned the foreign secretary at the time, Jack Straw, that he believed military action to be unlawful. Sir Michael Wood, the chief legal advisor of the Foreign Office, said it was the first and only occasion in his 30 years there that his legal advice had been ignored. His evidence blew apart assertions made repeatedly by Blair's ministers and advisors at the time of Elizabeth Wilmshurst's resignation that her views were not shared by her boss, Michael Wood, or other lawyers at the Foreign Office. In other news of that inquiry, see, while President Obama had to face Republicans this week, Tony Blair had to face an inquiry into the Iraq War. A little different. And his claims at that inquiry that Iran now poses as serious a threat as Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Well, that would be interesting. Those claims have been dismissed as, quote, a piece of spin by the British ambassador to Iran. Sir Richard Dalton was fiercely critical of Blair's testimony at the Iran inquiry, in which Blair compared Iran's nuclear proliferation to the perceived threat of Saddam Hussein's weapons program before the war. This from the Times of London. Blair said the international community must now be prepared to take a very hard, tough line with Iran.
But the current British ambassador said Blair was only suggesting a harder line with Iran to justify his own military action against Iraq. Blair and others testifying at the Iraq inquiry also said it never occurred to them that after Saddam Hussein was toppled, his longtime enemy, Iran, would try to make trouble in the post-war Iraq, or in Blair's term, be provocative. Never occurred to them. Also from the Times of London, Tony Blair offered British support to join the United States in overthrowing Hussein 6 months before 9/11, even though Blair's main rationale at the inquiry was that the calculus of threat in the world had changed after 9/11. A top-secret Downing Street memo says that Saddam's weapons of mass destruction would be used as a reason to take action against Iraq. A section of the document titled Regime Change says the U.S. and U.K. would need to remake the case against Saddam Hussein. A contract with the Iraqi people. That rings a bell. The contract would make clear the Iraqi regime's record and behavior, make it impossible for Iraq to meet the criteria for rejoining the international community without fundamental change, says the top-secret document. It appears to contradict Tony Blair's claims to the Iraq inquiry. He denied any serious consideration had been given to overthrowing the regime until 9/11. Perjury, babe? Under oath? No. The memo was accompanied by a letter from Blair's foreign policy advisor at the time and current head of British intelligence agency MI6, saying it's a confidential document and should not be shown to anyone outside Her Majesty's government. It was declassified moments before Blair began testifying at the inquiry. The Attorney General at the time of the invasion warned Blair and his foreign secretary that regime change was not a legal basis for war. Enough about Iraq. What about Afghanistan? The British newspaper The Guardian reports that the Taliban leader in Afghanistan, Mullah Omar, is ready to break with his al-Qaeda allies in order to make peace in the country. That's according to the former Pakistani intelligence officer who trained him. Imagine that. A Pakistani intelligence officer trained the head of the Afghan Taliban. Wouldn't you know? It is AFPAC, after all. Brigadier Sultan Amir Tarar, retired officer with Pakistan's ISI intelligence agency, says the moment he gets control, the first target will be the al-Qaeda people. He wants peace in his country. He doesn't want adventure. He's had enough of that. Few know the Taliban as well as Tarar, sometimes called the godfather of the Taliban, owing to his pivotal role in fostering the group's emergence during Afghanistan's 1990s civil war. That's right. Pakistani intelligence officer we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen. Our friends. Speaking at his home in Rawalpindi, the 65-year-old downplayed the significance of reports that the head of the UN mission to Afghanistan met senior Taliban commanders earlier this month in Dubai. The people who went over there didn't have any value. There were no hardcore people from Mullah Omar's group, he said. He added Taliban talks could only succeed through direct engagement with Omar. Gee, we've just met. It's a little sudden. Tarar still speaks affectionately of his former student, who has not been seen publicly since 2001. He is a good man. He is for his country, not for any mischief. Tarar was a key link between Pakistani intelligence and the Taliban when he was posted to Afghanistan in the 1990s. He was popular with Afghan militants for his enthusiastic embrace of their culture and his shared religious zeal. He shares the hostility to U.S. policy common to many Pakistani officers. That's right, our friend, Pakistan. The Afghan war cannot succeed because there is a lack of conviction, he said. If the Americans bring a superior faith or a convincing cause, they can win. But they don't have it, he says. Even their own soldiers are unhappy. Well, there'll be more of them, babe. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Speaking of Pakistan, we learned this week that Pakistani President Zardari has a black goat slaughtered at his home almost every day to ward off evil eyes and protect him from black magic. This according to the Pakistani newspaper, The Dawn. This almost every day. What's the matter with that other day? The goats are slaughtered as an act of sadaqah, meaning sadaqah's back, meaning voluntary charity in Islam. It's been an old practice of Mr. Zardari to offer sadaqah. He has been doing this for a long time, his spokesman told the paper. Hundreds of goats have been sacrificed at Zardari's house since he was sworn in September of 2008, according to the newspaper. Hey, they got the curry. Why not the goats? And, ladies and gentlemen, now, news of the digital wonderland.
High def, low def, no def, take my hand. It's a digital wonderland. Got to be so careful where you stand. In the digital wonderland.
In the unintended consequences department, human beings are making it harder for extraterrestrials to pick up our broadcasts and make contact. That's according to the world's leading expert on the search for alien life. At a special meeting on that search, the U.S. astronomer Frank Drake, who's been seeking radio signals from alien civilizations for almost 50 years, told scientists Earthlings are now making it less likely they would be heard in outer space. Astronomers assume that a standard technique for any alien intelligence trying to find other civilizations in the galaxy would involve seeking signals from TV, radio, and radar broadcasts, Drake told the Royal Society in London. Scientists on Earth have been using this method without success so far to find evidence of intelligent aliens. Theory is that elsewhere in the galaxy, other civilizations would be doing the same thing. The trouble is, says Dr. Drake, we're making ourselves more and more difficult to be heard. We are broadcasting in much more efficient ways today and are making our signals fainter and fainter. In the past, don't you know, TV and radio signals were broadcast from huge ground stations that transmitted signals at thousands of watts. They could be picked up relatively easily across the depths of space. Now most TV and radio programs are transmitted from satellites that typically use only 75 watts and have aerials pointing towards Earth rather than into space. For good measure, in America, we have switched from analog to digital broadcasting, and you're going to do the same in Britain. When you do that, says Dr. Drake, your transmissions will become four times fainter because digital uses less power. Very soon, he adds, we will be undetectable. No one will hear us in space except Art Bell and George Norrie. What is true for humans would probably also be true for aliens who may already have moved to digital TV and radio. You think aliens are that dumb? Trying to find E.T. from their favorite shows was going to be harder than we thought, Drake said. Although most scientists at the meeting say they're still sure life exists on other worlds. Meanwhile, the FCC is trying to make it easier for the aliens. Digital FM radio stations will be able to boost their signal power by up to 10 dB, or 10% of analog power levels, to increase the digital signal range. Not because of the aliens. Because automakers and receiver manufacturers of HD radio, that's digital radio to you, have expressed concerns about how far the signals cover and consumer reactions to products that may not have the same coverage as analog receivers, meaning just another reason the consumers have had for not buying HD, so-called HD radios. These issues, according to HD radio developer Ibiquity, quote, continue to provide impediments to the successful rollout of HD radio broadcasting, unquote. And in case you're wondering, unlike the HD and HD TV, the HD and HD radio is not an abbreviation for high definition. According to the manufacturer, Ibiquity, HD is a trademark brand name and doesn't actually stand for anything. Well, that's a common position in America today. News of the Digital Wonderland, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. More with John Cleary moments away. The trailer industry and members of Congress are pressing the United States government to send to Haiti thousands of potentially formaldehyde-laced trailers left over from Hurricane Katrina. That's a good idea. The 100,000 trailers became a symbol of the FEMA's bungled response to Katrina. The government had brought the trailer. You know this story. Now, the Agency for International Development, which is coordinating American assistance to Haiti, has expressed no interest in sending the trailers to Haiti. And the Haitian Culture and Communications Minister says, I don't think we would use them. I don't think we would accept them. But in a letter to FEMA, Representative Benny Thompson of Mississippi, chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, says the trailers could be used as temporary shelters or emergency clinics. That's just what Haiti needs, FEMA trailers. Don't bother to thank us. We're just here to help. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline Everett Washington, a former Arlington, Washington Little League coach accused of bringing children with him when he broke into an abandoned building, was sentenced this week to 15 days in jail. George Spady Jr. pleaded guilty to second-degree burglary. I'm sorry, he said. I know I did something wrong. Investigators said he was with his son, a nephew, and another boy who was a player from his baseball team last March 21 when he broke into a vacant shop and took bolts and overhead lights. But the kids learned a valuable lesson. Always take a look out. Dateline Louisville, Kentucky. Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson has apologized for a comment he made to a West Virginia newspaper. He said during an interview the city was, quote, getting poorer, blacker, and older before the 2003 merger of city and county government. He now says in a written statement he apologizes if it's my favorite kind of apology, if anyone was offended by his comments. He said he was merely attempting to describe the demographic trends in our community at the time of the merger vote. Well, who could be offended by demography? Representative Dina Titus, Democrat of Nevada, apologized this week for causing U.S. Senator Harry Reid any political heartburn by privately saying the Democrats, from President Obama to Reid to Titus herself, were effed and could lose re-election if they failed to learn from the GOP victory in Massachusetts. Her comments were made a week ago to fellow House freshmen, leaked on a political website. She admitted using profanity but denied singling out Reid. I certainly apologize to him for any problems this has caused him. But I didn't say he was dead or was going to lose. I said from the president on down to myself, if we don't get the message, that we're all in trouble. But the president went to speak to Republicans. That's backbone. A top official of Philadelphia-based Aramark has apologized at a hearing by Pennsylvania lawmakers into the mess that caused the cafeteria at the state capitol in Harrisburg to be closed down last month because of health violations. Rodent droppings that the inspector said were too numerous to mention. According to Bruce Walton, VP of Aramark, we take this extremely seriously. There was a breakdown in operational procedures. We are sorry. Dateline Portland, Oregon. Portland Trailblazer Center Greg Oden is apologizing for nude photos that have surfaced on the internet. Oden says the pictures taken with his cell phone and sent to a former girlfriend were taken about a year and a half ago. Well, that explains everything. A friend told the 21-year-old basketball player this week that the pictures were making the rounds on the internet. I would like to apologize to everybody, Portland, the fans, the organization, he told reporters at the Blazers practice facility. It was very embarrassing. Oden is out again for this season. Plenty of time to take nude pictures of himself now. India apologized to its citizens for a government advertisement aimed at promoting female children that showed a former Pakistani Air Force chief. The Indian Prime Minister's office called it a lapse The Prime Minister's office apologizes to the public for it. Arlen Specter, Senator of Pennsylvania, called Representative Michelle Bachmann this week to apologize for his comments during a radio interview last week, saying she should act like a lady. Congresswoman has accepted the apology. And way over in Davos, Switzerland, Davos, the president of Toyota said he was sorry for making customers feel uneasy after the Japanese carmaker was forced to recall millions of cars across the globe because of faulty accelerator pedals. Akio Toyoda said, "We're extremely sorry to have made customers feel uneasy." The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This is Le Show. Our guest is John Cleary. And I have to ask you a rude question. I'm used to, because of family and other, and just following, you know, from Tom Jones onward, the fact that Welsh people can sing soulfully and occasionally Scott. How does normally you don't connect the words English and soulful.
Well, you know.
Or am I wrong?
Well, my family's all Irish back in the day.
I see.
Maybe it was the Celtic blood.
Yeah,
it's
the Celtic thing, of course.
So, but you know, that whole soulful thing, it doesn't matter where you're from, really. You can find soulful music anywhere you go if you look hard enough for it. And I was lucky because I grew up in a family of soulful musicians.
Now, you I know from talking to you and hanging with you that you're a total Johnny Guitar Watson maniac.
Yeah, I love Johnny Watson.
But was that something that you were into at the time? Or who was the reigning funk kings of England when you were there? Or were there such a thing?
Well, I left England when I was...
Was it Hot Chocolate?
17. God. I mean... you know, I was too young, really, for the kind of to be into the soul thing when it was happening.
Mm.
You know, 1973 was when a lot of great soul records were made, and I was 11 years old.
Ah, yeah.
So the stuff that my peers were listening to was whatever was on Top of the Pops that week, which was usually Gary Glitter's glam rock. You know, and then the Sex Pistols came along, and that was pretty mind blowing. But when you go, so with the gigs I could go and see as a kid were punk rock gigs. We'd see the, you know, all the punk bands. But at that time in England, every time when you went to a punk gig, there was always a reggae band on the bill. There was always, would be a punk band and a reggae band. So I got to see all these great Jamaican bands. So that was our kind of soul music in England, if you like. The stuff we had access to was Jamaican music.
Mm. Well, that's not bad.
Yeah, so I got to, man, in the late 70s, got to see great, you know, Mighty Diamonds, Culture, Gladiators. Steel Pulse, Asrad, Mutumbi, all the English reggae stuff, and Dennis Bavell. So that was kind of the soul stuff. And then, you know, I was listening to New Orleans R&B, and that really was the stuff that got me. I loved just that. Oh, you know. That was the stuff that really pressed all my buttons. And then after moving here and learning a little bit more and getting to play with guys like Walter Washington and Johnny Adams and playing in a lot of the little black bars in New Orleans and hearing and just, you know, being a funk detective and checking out the jukeboxes, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, Johnny Taylor, Little Milton, Tyrone Davis. That stuff really, that was the stuff that really got me.
Tyrone, Can I Change My Mind, Davis?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that then really, that got me pretty hard. You know, the real good old Southern soul music.
So then you form a band at one point. And I'd been aware of you as a player and as a performer, but when this band broke on the New Orleans scene, I think it knocked a lot of people for a major loop. It was the funkiest stuff that I'd heard since the original Meters had fled the scene. How'd you put that band together? How'd you come up with the name? And it was also, New Orleans is a great music town. It's not always a great record making town. That was that John Cleary and the Absolute Monster Gentleman record is a great sounding record. It's a real
Thank
record.
You.
Yeah.
Well, I'd The first time I put a band together in New Orleans was after having lived here for a couple of years. I lived here for 2 years and just looked and learnt and listened a lot. And then I went back to England. I had to leave and go back. And that was when I first got my experience at hiring musicians, hustling gigs, plugging in PA systems, getting paid at the end of the night.
The glamour stuff.
Yeah, and all that. So, yeah, the nuts and bolts of the trade, really, just being a working musician. So I felt, having done that, when I then came back to New Orleans, that I was then equipped to kind of do it and do it right. Prior to that, I spent most of my time just listening, soaking it up and shedding. And I had a piano in the house. I moved to play for hours every day. And then the first band I put together, you know, I was quite cheeky. I would call the best players in town. So the very first band I put together in New Orleans had George Porter on bass, Walter Washington on guitar, Kenneth Blevins on drums. They made great. And I would always hire the baddest musicians. Because that's, you know, that's what you do if you're going to get, if you want to sound good, surround yourself with the best cat. So I got to play with guys from, you know, Demeters, from George Porter, and then Fats Domino's rhythm section. I'd hire them for little. And these are just little gigs, and you know, as I said, it was a bit cheeky of me, but I realised, man, they're all musicians. They all need gigs. They're happy, and if you can, you know, the first gig, if they dig it, then they don't mind you calling them back, and they always dug it because I was playing the old stuff that they grew up with. So I was hiring guys that were sort of 20 or 30 years older than me, but I was calling out songs that they recognized from when they were teenagers, because that's kind of what I grew up listening to. And so I got spoiled, you know, all these great musicians. But I found that as much as I loved doing the old obscure New Orleans standards and Little Willie John tunes, these songs that I could call without having to have rehearsals, knowing that these guys would know him, be able to jump in and fall straight in. At the same time, I was writing songs and I wasn't able to play them because I needed to have guys that would learn these songs. They'd never heard those before, so it was a different kettle of fish altogether. So around that time, I put together a band with some musicians that I'd become friends with who were in a gospel band called the Friendly Travelers. And I sort of broke with the tradition, and for Jazz Fest one year, instead of using the old cats, the session players, I used these guys whose experience was really playing coffee bars and playing in church, not playing festivals and nightclubs and all that. But they were great players and nice guys, and they were agreeable to getting together and working, rehearsing and learning the stuff. So that's the band I put together. And we needed a name for the band, and around that time, Johnny Guitar Watson came out of retirement and came to perform in New Orleans. And it's hard to come up with a good name for a band, and ask all your friends for ideas, and everyone comes up with stupid ideas or double entendre. You know, it soon degenerates into the silliest name anyone could think of. But Johnny Watson introduced one of the musicians on the band as an absolute monster gentleman, and I thought, ah, that's it. That's the name, the absolute monster gentleman.
So it came from Johnny Guitar Watson?
Johnny Guitar Watson, yeah, deserves the credit. Mm. So that was the band, John Cleary and the Absolute Monster Gentleman.
Yeah. And that band was together for, and it broke up?
For about 10 years. Mm. And it's not really broken up. We'll still be doing gigs here and there. Mm. But the challenge is to try and have as broad a musical diet as possible, you know. And so it's fun to have the luxury here of playing with as many great musicians as you can. And so recently I've been doing trio gigs with just a different timbre, a different texture of music. So it's more acoustic piano with upright bass, as opposed to the Monster Gents thing, which is kind of electric R&B and funk.
And you've also been doing solo gigs, to my great delight, as well.
I've been doing some solo gigs. I used to do a lot of solo gigs back in the day, but I'm kind of digging it now, yeah.
It's I bow to no one in my admiration for that band, but, you know, I'll always come hear you play solo. Could you do something else for us right now?
Sure. I know what I'll do. I'll play you a blues. This is Port Street Blues. I used to live on Port Street, and this funky old falling down house about 100 yards from the Mississippi River in the old part of town of New Orleans. And this one, I lived there for about 15 years in this beautiful old place, man. It was great. And so when I'd be away on tour, I'd always get homesick for New Orleans. And this is all about missing New Orleans, and it's called Port Street Blues. Camelback Riverside Shack, a Creole shotgun little yard out back. Cool breezing, wriggling, blowing through my banana trees, yawning. Rusty freight ship drifting in from an ocean far away. Cast long shadows on my back porch at the sad time of day. I'm just trying to tell y'all about a feeling I can't lose. I'm a long way from home, yeah, and I got the Port Street blues. There's a beat up piano that cha-cha's out of tune. And in the corner there's a messed up jukebox, take up all the room. You can't sit down for stacks and stacks of scratched up 45s, and them cobwebs hang from the ceiling fan, blow the smoke back in your eyes. But the door is always open if you somewhere close by around, and the walls always shaking to a sweet soulful sound. I'm just trying to tell you all about them, a feeling I can't lose. I'm a long way from home, oh no, Lord, I got the Pawn Street blues. Down on Port Street, I'm gonna kick out both my shoes. Pull me out the first one, y'all. Oh, slap on my grocery grooves. I'm calling on a friend of travelers. I'm gonna hear the wolfman howl the blues. I'm hanging with the funk captain, y'all. Back on Port Street, FHQ. Port Street. You know that's the only place I find. Oh, oh, yeah, I can rest my worried heart. I can rest my worried heart. I can rest my worried heart. Yeah, and pacify my mind. Ooh.
You buttoned yourself. Having come up in the way you did and insinuating yourself so marvelously and so seamlessly into the New Orleans musical culture, now you're sort of a, not to say that you're an old fart, but you're a senior member of the community, an esteemed member of the musical community. Are young kids still coming in here and doing what you did and sort of learning it, going home and playing hours a day and going out all night and showing up and saying, could I sit in for a little bit and just play this stuff? And
I think they are, actually.
Steeped in the thing still?
I think they are. I think they are. I certainly hope they are. I don't think there's ever been a time when there's been more music in New Orleans than now.
Mm.
Which is a great thing to say. So recently after the storm, when I first came here, the club listings were tiny. You could
really
fit them all on like half a page.
Really?
Yeah, it was really in the kind of doldrums. And now there's clubs everywhere.
Yeah.
I don't know that, even though in spite of the fact there's a lot of music in town, I don't know how much of it is New Orleans music or being played by New Orleans musicians or people that are steeped in the New Orleans tradition. There's a variety of all sorts of different things you can go and hear, which
is
great.
Yeah.
But I think the, times change and fashions change and the way people make music changes. These days, someone that's inclined to play keyboards or mess with music will probably end up with a computer and a digital keyboard, and the tools are different now.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time when every barroom, every household had a piano. That's not really the case. There aren't even that many clubs in New Orleans that have good pianos. That's sad to say.
Good pianos, but they got pianos.
Well, not that many even have pianos,
really?
Good or bad, really.
I mean, when I first came, which is now 20 years ago, I used to be amazed at the fact that in this city, college kids would come to a bar where a piano blues trio would be playing as opposed to top 40 music or cover band, It seemed like, well, this is one of a kind.
Yeah, I know. Sad to say, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
But yeah, there's still more music here than anywhere else, I think, in the States.
It is amazing.
Almost more good music, anyway.
You talked about computers, but you've got some chops in that department. You did this little record, this little 4-song EP on your own, sort of just
on my laptop.
On your
laptop,
on tour.
No, they're all great tools. I think I'm very fortunate to have kind of straddled to the pre-computers and post-computers. Computers, if you're a musician, allow you to do all sorts of great stuff. I mean, nowadays you can fit into a laptop computer what previously would have filled up an entire room in an expensive studio. But it's no substitute for learning the craft. You have to be an artisan. There's an element to that, and there's a long tradition in New Orleans of people who were craftsmen, and they're proud of the craft, and that's not something you pick up overnight. There are no shortcuts. So I think there's a danger that young musicians coming up will think that they can use a computer and correct everything with the press of a button. And it's important to know how to play. And to play with some soul, you've got to be able to something.
I have seen a bunch of software programs for music and sound. I have yet to see one that has a Funkify button on it.
No, I by nature, I think I am something of a Luddite, but I was converted to the computers fairly on and what they can do. I mean, it's great. You have to be a musician. They're just tools.
Mm-hmm.
They're just tools. They can't come up with the ideas.
Yeah,
they can make a lot of the work easier for someone that doesn't have that many ideas. but I think that's one of the reasons why we're bombarded with such large volumes of mediocre music these days.
And I thought you accomplished a very difficult trick on that EP, and why I raved about it when I first saw you after hearing it, is that it sounded like it was music going on. It sounded like you were playing with guys. It had that looseness of...
That's the challenge, really.
Yeah.
And I came up playing music, playing different instruments. I can play a bunch of different instruments, and I started very young, and I've played every day of my life, so I've had time to kind of work on a few different things. So for me, it's great, because if I'm writing a song, if I'm recording a piece of music and I have a specific idea about the feel, then it's much easier for me to play the different parts than to try and translate it. And there are pitfalls with that too. But coming back to Johnny Guitar Watson, I saw him being interviewed on TV on a clip. He's on Soul Train, and he played all the instruments on his records. And the guy said, "Man, what are you trying to put musicians out of a job or something?" And he said, "No, and it's not that. It's just that sometimes it's important that all the instruments have the same attitude." And that's exactly the way I embrace the technology and the ability to actually write a song, compose a song in my head, hear how it's supposed to sound, and then be able to go and play all the individual parts. So that they will have the right attitude.
The right attitude. That's great.
You know that I would sit here and talk with you and make you play music all day, but you got an important thing to go to. So can you play us out with like an instrumental thing? And
sure.
Thank you so much for sharing your time and your talent with us.
Thank you for having me. It's great. Great to be able to do this. Let me see. This is something I've just been messing with. So a little kind of the Caribbean aspect of New Orleans.
My thanks to John Cleary for being my extra special guest today on Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz. On the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available on your smartphone through Stitcher.com, available as a free download for members at Audible.com, and available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. And it would be just like having just enough rodent droppings that you could count at the state capitol cafeteria in Pennsylvania if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Already, thank you very much, huh? A tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. Thanks again, indeed, as well, to John Fishback at Piety Street Studios here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Email address of this broadcast and the playlist of the recorded music heard hereon can always be found at harryshearer.com. And Le Show is on Twitter, at LeTwits. Le Show comes to you from KCRW Santa Monica, the home of the homeless.